Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Investing in America 101 podcast hosted by Invest America. The goal of this podcast is to provide education, insights, and commentary from U.S. investment and immigration professionals centered around private investments in the U.S. that we make available for investment from non-U.S. individual investors, either to facilitate their immigration to the United States for themselves and their families, and or to help them diversify their portfolio into non-immigration related private U.S. investments. Welcome to episode 2 of our podcast services titled EB-5 Reauthorization, What Has Changed? A lot has changed in the last couple of months, and we're going to be having that discussion today. My name is Mike Zenick. I'm the president, CEO, and founder of Invest America, and happy to have you join us again today for this podcast of our recurring series. And today we're going to be speaking with one of the preeminent and experienced immigration attorneys, Christian Triantafylos of Jackson Walker Law Firm. A little background on Christian. He leads Jackson Walker's investment immigration practice, representing foreign nationals and immigration immigrant investors in cross-border and business immigration matters, usually dealing with regional centers and direct investments. In his practice, Christian regularly serves as a counsel to real estate developers, regional centers, private equity funds, and family offices, and advises those in structuring potential EB-5 funding by providing analysis on project business plans, securities offerings, and economic reports. He's become particularly experienced assisting foreign nationals, entrepreneurs, and high net worth families from around the world through the EB-5 and visa program, preparing and filing I-526 petitions and I-829 petitions for regional centers and direct investors. So with that introduction, I'd like to welcome Christian. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate being here.
Absolutely. And as before we get started, I think it's fair to inform everybody that your name and my name are very hard to pronounce for the layman, the layperson involved. And we're both fellow Greeks of Greek descent. And we share that probably one of the unique shared experiences in the EB-5 industry.
That's right. And at least we could pronounce each other's last names.
That's right. So thanks for joining us again today. And we're going to be going through a variety of topics. Obviously, the focus is the EB-5 reauthorization centered around the EB-5 Reform and Integrity Act of 2022 that Congress passed in March of this year. So I guess before we even get to that point, can you give us, your perspective and just a brief overview for those that don't know, brief overview of what the EB-5 program is and how it benefits investors?
Sure. Happy to do that. So the EB-5 program is a program that was set up in 1990 and has experienced some changes since then that offers an opportunity for foreign investors to make an investment in the United States that should result in the creation of at least 10 jobs on behalf of that investor. And the benefit is that the investor and immediate family members can become lawful permanent residents of the United States. So it is one of our immigrant categories that we have in our immigration system, the fifth category, and therefore called EB-5, that foreign investors, those with the financial resources, can take advantage of if interested in immigrating to the U.S.
Great. Thank you for that brief introduction there. If you were to guess, how many individual EB-5 investors do you think you've represented over the years?
Well, it's over 1,000 now. And of course, I've always worked with a team of attorneys and paralegals to help me get through the number of clients that or cases that we work on each year. But, I started getting heavily involved in this industry in 2011, 2012, and in those earlier years, we had two types of practices. within the EB5 practice group, one in which we worked very closely with high net worth individuals from places like Mexico, Europe, Africa. And then we had sort of the migration agent, broker dealer run cases where there was sort of higher volume. And that was kind of rare early on in this space, where I remember being part of a team where we handled 100 to 200 cases a year for 4 to 5 years. So it's really a kind of evolved into high volume or close, holding the hand of a client type of practices. And I've always been involved in both spaces and therefore have worked on many, many cases over the years.
Amazing. I know we've worked on several investors together, you on the immigration side, us on the investment side. I think proud to say that I think we've make a pretty good team when it comes to getting you what you need for your client and providing what we need for our EB5 project clients. And also making sure that, you know, the EB5 investor is fully informed and making sure that they know everything about the investment, everything is transparent, and, you know, we help them to answer whatever questions they've got. And it's been great to work on those cases together and look forward to doing more of that in the future.
Yeah, if I might just add to that, Mike, sure. Completely agree. And I do think sort of the more modern EB5 world, it requires exactly those types of relationships where they're fully understanding from the financial side. I don't provide financial due diligence advice, but also, you know, very much one-on-one contact with their attorneys as well. And I know that with our mutual clients, you know, you and I have been able to answer kind of that full gamut of questions and concerns and interests that our mutual clients have in the space.
We certainly have. And it's interesting having, before I got into EB5 back in 2010, 2011, and most of my experience was on the institutional side, working with institutional investors, institutional companies. And as I transitioned to doing, working with individual investors, no two cases are the same. After over the hundreds and for you guys, thousands of investors that you've worked on, having to, you know, sort of be nimble and adjust your thought process and your approach and your perspective. And it's amazing what people will ask for, sometimes very obscure information that, you know, is important to them, but doesn't really have a major factor in the project. But I've been very interested or very intrigued, even to this day, after working on hundreds of these cases and hundreds of families. There's always something new that you get encounter with each individual investor.
You're right about that, Mike. This morning, just had a conference call with a client that we're trying to finalize their I-526 petition and. You know, sort of learned about a new wrinkle of a credit facility that he's using to fund his EB5 investment that I just was not aware of, and that's okay. He educated me on that, so I'll be able to use even more information going forward when working with clients in the future. So yes, agreed. Always something new.
Good deal. All right. So we know how it benefits the investors and their families. They get the green card and obviously the opportunity to live and work in the United States and especially for people with families, allowing their kids to go to school here, et cetera. What do you see as the benefits for the U.S. in general, as well as the projects that they're investing in?
Sure. So yes, I mean, certainly the family investing, the investor is seeking out the green card benefits that come along with being a permanent resident, you know, getting a social security card, access to the U.S. education system, long-term solution to settling in the United States. On the U.S. Developer side, this has been an identifiable way to seek capital from alternative sources rather than just financing through the traditional banks or other high interest private equity or mezzanine funding. The EB-5 investment can come in and serve as a lower interest or lower cost form of capital for developers to develop whatever kind of business they're interested in, whether it's real estate, hotel accommodation, software companies, manufacturing companies, all kinds of different developers, business owners have been able to use EB-5 funds to develop and grow their business and at a lower cost than they would otherwise from other forms of financing. And so that's a big part of it. The other overall benefit stemming from the EB-5 program is the emphasis on job creation. So we've seen two types of job creation over the years. The direct job creation, which means that an investor is investing directly into a company and there's going to be W-2 full-time 35-hour week workers or employees, and there needs to be at least 10 of those job types of employees created. As compared to the regional center job creation, where you're looking at indirect slash reduced jobs from an economic study showing the overall economic impacts of that project that the investor is investing in. So that's now you're looking at hundreds, if not thousands of jobs of economic impact stemming from the investment. So job creation has always been extremely important to the program and always been a big benefit to various areas around the United States.
Yeah, I've, having worked obviously on our side, even though ultimately we end up representing the investors once they invest as a U.S. securities firm, that's our role after the investment. Before we get there, we're dealing with the projects and the regional centers that are raising the capital and that we are representing to find suitable investors for them. It's interesting to see how this has evolved over time. You know, we've encountered lots of people along the way, some who were very focused on EB-5 being the only source of capital for their projects, which we typically did not follow up with those projects. And I think that was a little bit of the olden days, so to speak, when especially when there was no other capital available back in the 2009, 10, 11 timeframes. But I think it's, what I've seen and my comment on this too is I think the EB-5 industry has evolved, albeit very small compared to the rest of the capital markets, a very good source of capital, the alternative source of capital that, as you said, benefits the developers to have a lower cost of capital. But especially with the price increasing, we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. You're getting a more and more sophisticated investor, and you're getting to where the EB-5 capital is smart money now, for in a lot of ways versus before it was kind of, blind money that investors really didn't know what was occurring. So, anyway, having sort of seen it from when I first started to now, I think I was thinking about it the other day and said, this really has evolved into a nice niche portion of the capital markets.
I agree with you on that. And the profile, the type of investor has changed over the years, especially with the higher amount, the more sophisticated investor. In addition, results in projects being up to snuff and meeting investors' demands and interest in terms of what they're investing in and the structure of that investment. So whether the full capital stack on the project needs to be already secured, whether there needs to be various lines of job creation that they're going to see that the investor is looking for to make sure that they have an extra job cushion on their investment, or other contracts put into place that help secure their investment in a way that makes them feel more comfortable about going forward. So yes, that's been a big part of the evolution of the program.
I'm glad we see eye to eye on that. I think it's hopefully continues to grow in that way. And obviously we're going to, next talk about some of the things that have changed and interesting to see how it evolves over the next several years with the new changes. So talking about that, we talked in the intro about this EB-5 Reform and Integrity Act that was passed by Congress and signed by President Biden on March 15th, that did some things, made some major changes to the program, obviously solidified it for a period of time, whereas we've had some, I think it was 32 extensions since September 30th, 2015. So maybe let's talk about maybe four or five of the key changes that you see that were enacted by this Reform and Integrity Act, either good or bad. Just wanted to get your perspective on what are some, four or five key changes that you think were implemented by this new act.
Sure. And I really like that you brought up the number of extensions that we saw in the past, because with those extensions came potential legislation along the way, which hadn't been passed until now. And of course, those drafts of legislation evolved over time as well. So I'm, looking at it from that perspective, I saw and reviewed what type of legislation was proposed over the last 5, 6, 7 years. And as a result, overall, I'm pretty satisfied with what was passed in March of 2022 with the EB-5 Reform and Integrity Act. I do think there are a number of benefits that I'd be happy to point out. I would say the first relief was the grandfathering of already filed EB-5 investors. Clients of mine might not have already benefited from that grandfathering clause because their I-526 petition is still pending, but I can assure them that it is now processing once again. And then going forward, as I talk with new clients interested in the program, we have that assurance that so long as we file the I-526 petition before the next time, before 2026, which is leading up to the next time the program is set to sunset, they will be grandfathered into the program as well. So I was a big part. I was very, very focused on trying to make sure grandfathering happened for those already filed. And of course, that was worked into the legislation. That kind of leads me into the longer term reauthorization of the Regional Center program. It being authorized or reauthorized to September 30th of 2027 gives us a nice longer runway to work under a kind of steady ground, if you will. In the past, when we were working from short-term extension to short-term extension, while it did create urgency within the market for investors to move forward because of their interest in landing in the program before it expired, it also created some instability and people having to make quick judgments on things. Primarily, clients and investors. And now they can think through what projects, what's the right timing for them to move forward. And also a longer runway for developers to know how long they can work under the EB-5 program under today's new rules. I have to say with the changes came the increased invested amounts. Before we had $1 million investment threshold or $500,000 if the project is located in a targeted employment area. And now we have it at $1,050,000 or $800,000 if the project is located in a targeted employment area, which I can get into in a bit. But, so far, so good on the invested amount. I haven't seen that scare off or cool too many potential clients I've spoken with. I don't think that's the key issue on any hesitation at the moment for at least most of the individuals I've been speaking with. And that could be just based off pent up demand that since the EB-5 Regional Center program was on hold for 9 months during 2021 to part of 2022. But it also could be that investors like the increased investor protections that were built into the program under the new legislation. Things like making sure that EB-5 funding is in a separate bank account than the other funding to be closely monitored, third-party fund administrators or audited financials being required by USCIS when handling the EB-5 funds. So, you know, making sure to keep close track of the EB-5 money, having an extra set of eyes on the EB-5 funds, I know makes investors feel even better about this program than they did before. I would say another part of the changes that I'll touch on are the what I believe are attempts to accelerate processing times and alleviate backlogs, EB-5 visa backlogs, especially for certain countries like China, Vietnam, and potentially India in the future. And here's what I mean by that. You know, within the new legislation, there were sort of directives from by Congress for USCIS to process various types of EB-5 petitions, whether it's the I-526 petition, the I-829 petition, the project application, and a certain number of months that are, you know, are under or well under a year. And you know, I think USCIS should take that to heart, and I believe that there will be pressure on USCIS to keep up with those deadlines in the future. In addition to that, you know, this whole idea of reserved visas, these reserves sort of set aside visas that Congress created for projects that are located in rural areas, high unemployment areas and, or urban areas and infrastructure projects. That's an opportunity for certain citizens from countries that have been traditionally backlogged to have a much faster EB-5 process than they ever anticipated. And with the rural category, we also have this idea of priority processing, which says that each step of the EB-5 process, from filing the I-526 petition to getting the conditional green card to removing the conditions on the conditional green card, should all be a faster timeline than any other category of EB-5. And that will be very interesting to see how regulations come out on that and how they're handled, how it's handled within USCIS. So those are the types of conversations I've been having with clients and potential clients since the passing of this new legislation, and mostly positive conversations, just that, you know, we cannot yet file I-526 petitions connected to regional center investments. And, you know, Mike, I don't know if you provide a little background on that, but that's kind of the elephant in the room at the moment.
Yes, it is for sure. And before we go there, because all the things you mentioned are certainly very, very great takeaways from the new legislation, I think there's a lot we could unpack on each of those. With this podcast, we don't have enough time to do that. But I will say that, you know, I think touching on a couple of things that you mentioned, you know, being on the other side of the fence, marketing EB-5 projects over the last 7 years since the last reauthorization, or almost 7 years, you know, having that uncertainty definitely was a damper on demand. And people were, you know, there was all these sort of, most of which turned out to be fictional deadlines, that, you know, it was kind of the boy crying wolf a million times over. Every time we told an investor that, well, you better do it before this time or it's not, or the program's going to go away. Well, that didn't actually happen, at least for you know, a long period of time until June 30th of last year. So, you know, that really, it's hard to get into a rhythm. It's hard to give investors confidence that they're investing in a program that's going to be around. And well, if it's sunsets, what does that mean? You know, so those are, I think the long-term reauthorization and, you know, long-term, you know, 5 years to us is long-term compared to what we've had in the last few years. So I definitely think that will help with, I think there is some pent-up demand. We're seeing it on our end, but I think it will also help with, you know, creating some sort of steady market for EB-5 going forward, notwithstanding other things that might dampen that, whether it's program related or economy related or something like that. The other thing I would say, go ahead, sorry.
Well, yeah, let me touch on one more piece of that, Mike. And I know that, you know, those deadlines, many of those deadlines did not come to fruition or mean anything in the end, but they were very much, you know, happening and potentially seemingly real at the time, considering the legislation, the drafts of legislation that was being floated around within the industry through certain staffers' offices in Congress. But it did sort of wind up leading to this idea that is this going to ever happen? Maybe not. And then, as you said, it finally did happen. The other item that I have to bring up is, you know, with processing times, you know, I speak with families and different potential investors all the time who have different issues going on in their lives, whether they're abroad or in the United States. And I would say the most urgent cases are usually those who are in the United States, and their current non-immigrant status may come to an end in the near future. And so one of the complications of EB-5 that sometimes allowed people to walk away from the program instead of going forward with it was how long it might take for the I-526 petition, the EB-5 petition that's first filed based on the investment, to get approved. Because in the past, we needed to wait for that I-526 petition to get approved before taking advantage of the next step of applying for the green card, the conditional green card. But under the new legislation, we now know that we can concurrently file the green card application, which means we can file it at the same time as filing the I-526 petition. So even as we wait for processing time to improve, we know we have an immediate advantage of being able to file that I-485 adjustment of status application for the conditional green card immediately if a client wants to when filing the I-526 petition, or sometime while the I-526 petition is still processing. And that allows an individual to remain in the United States and eventually get a work permit and travel permit while waiting out the EB-5 process, even if their non-immigrant visa status expires in the future. And that has it's been interesting for me because it changes how I initiate a case, initiate my work with working with a family in the U.S. We're doing two types of applications at the same time, and it also provides a lot of relief on the investor, on the client side, in terms of knowing that even if the timelines don't improve immediately or in the near future, they at least have a landing spot for now once we get that I-526 petition with adjustment of status application on file. I'm sure, Mike, you know, you've seen probably some of that be beneficial to your conversations with clients too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially when it comes to people that are doing it for their kids that are here, you know, going to school, getting ready to graduate, and they may or may not have an avenue via, you know, OPT or H-1B or other things that will allow them to stay here. Having that concurrent filing opportunity and to adjust their status is really, you know, I think an amazing, it's a game changer in my view. I think that will in and of itself drive demand that probably that you know, may not have been around before. It incentivizes people that maybe even here on vacation, you know, on a tourist visa to time that perfectly and take advantage of that. So yeah, I think that's one of the unanticipated outcomes of this legislation that I think, you know, was certainly interesting, but I don't think I think the fact that it's there now is very intriguing. I think it'll definitely help demand. As I said before, there's lots of the things that you touched on that we can unpack, but I want to move along here to talk about the issue that's out there right now. You mentioned the elephant in the room regarding the USCIS's interpretation of certain areas of the new legislation. Can you give us a little background on that, and you know, what's the issue? What's the problem there?
Okay, well, there are still a few, several pieces of the legislation that need clarification, but it sounds to me like you're alluding to the regional center designation issue, which is that when the new legislation was passed in March, USCIS later in April, late April, came out and said that according to the new legislation, USCIS is saying that regional centers must apply using a newly issued form called the I-956 form to get designated as a regional center. And I know that sounds funny because how regional centers should apply to get designated as a regional center. Essentially, they're saying if you're a regional center before, that's all said and done. You're no longer considered to be a regional center under the new legislation, and you have to apply for that to happen. I've thought about it, considering it, you know, thought of it as being recertified, reauthorized. I mean, the way the form reads is to be an application for a regional center designation. Now, when I've worked on these so far, I certainly bring up the fact that they've been operating compliantly for years and all those good things. But the bottom line is, you know, they also said that EB-5 investors cannot file an I-526 petition until, in connection with a regional center project, until the regional center that they're investing under, until that application has been approved. So we are now waiting for approvals of these I-956 regional center applications from USCIS, so we can start filing I-526 petitions for EB-5 investors. But at the same time, there is a lawsuit that is definitely underway. There have been multiple hearings in California, led by Bering Regional Center. And I'm not a part of the lawsuit. I'm not, counsel to it, but I've certainly been following it closely, been one of the lucky few to be able to log in to the Zoom link to watch the hearings and get the and kind of see what I think about the judge's reaction to the different arguments, to Bering's arguments and to USCIS's arguments. And I can tell you, for the first hearing, my impression was that the lawsuit wasn't going very far because of the way the judge and USCIS were acting in that hearing. But things changed rather dramatically based on the second hearing that I observed. And it really seems like the judge is planning to lean in Bering's favor to say that these I-956 applications, this need to get designated as a regional center under the new legislation, might not be necessary. And at the very least, should be put on hold until a more major decision has been made on this. I felt like, and was kind of heard through the grapevine, that there would have been a decision on this in favor of Bering 1 to 2 weeks ago, until sort of the industry as a whole, the EB-5 industry as a whole, sort of swooped in and said, this is going to be a decision that affects all of us. So if you're going to make a decision, let's be sure that we're all a part of that decision, which I completely understand. So from what I know or observed, it seems as though we're waiting for a decision from the judge on what he thinks about this whole redesignation of this designation requirement, and whether he's going to keep it in place or whether he's going to temporarily put it on hold until things play out under litigation, or perhaps he looks for USCIS to act in a reasonable time, maybe 30 to 60 days on these regional center applications, and they have to revisit this in court if we don't see results on the USCIS side, in a timely manner. But this is all sort of based off observation, discussions, and thoughts that I've heard from others and formulated on my own. None of this is from the inside of the courtroom or the legal team working on it.
Right. Yeah. And I was also on both of those hearings. Like you said, lucky enough to get into the first 100 people that were listening. And I had the same take as you. I think the first one, without getting too critical of one side or another and how they presented their arguments. It was a bit of a disaster for the regional centers. And I think that everybody, a lot of people in the industry listening to that first hearing were very frustrated. I thought the judge actually gave the regional centers a bit of a break when he allowed for supplemental information and briefs to be provided. I think, clearly neither side had fully satisfied him as far as some of the questions he had. So it really gave the regional centers an opportunity to kind of, in my view, come from behind and where they were to kind of get things back in shape. And I think, I think I have the same impression of what the judge was thinking in the last hearing. And, I think we're getting daily inquiries from our investors or investors that are looking at our projects of what's going on. When is it going to happen? Has it happened yet? And I know that, the regional centers and the project entities that are looking to finalize their offering documents are also anxiously awaiting, because they will need to put some finishing touches on those documents and before they can, get them out to really be, or at least provide supplemental information to what they may already have out to cover whatever things might come about. And that actually may be the case for several months as they continue to codify the legislation. So without going down that path too much, because that might be a little bit of a boring conversation for people that are listening. I think we're looking to, kind of wrap things up here shortly. Because before we move to the end, any other, and we both talked a little bit about, investor demand, how the new legislation, new rules, will affect investor demand. So I think we feel pretty good about that. And the second part of that question is will it continue to be useful to developers to fund their projects? I know, before I let you answer that question, we're having some conversations now with people that are either legacy EB-5 people that are used to using EB-5 for their projects, as well as several new developers. I've got a guy right across the hall from me that works for, he owns a real estate development company. And, I told him what I did, and I got on the phone with all of his partners, and they're contemplating using it. There's a couple of new regional centers that are looking to get started. What's your perspective on maybe what you're hearing from maybe people that are looking for the first time to go after EB-5 capital? Do you think it's going to bode well for them with the new legislation?
Yeah, and I'm really glad you touched on that. I have to say, one of my also recent observations has been this sort of reinvigorated interest in the regional center program by first-time developers or business owners who, I've had more of those types of conversations over the last 2 to 3 months than I've had for a number of 2 to 3 years, because prior to that, it was very much dominated by the sort of well-known actors in the space, which they have a role in the program, absolutely. And then those who are looking to get into it for the first time, understanding that there's new legislation, a longer reauthorization period, which gives them kind of a better assurance about raising money for the first time under the program, I think goes a long way. And from just everyone being involved, to know that there's extra bells and whistles, that are having to be adhered to for the safety of the investors also, I think just helps everyone's mindset going into it that, I better hire up all the right kind of consultants, counsel, to make sure I'm following these rules to a T moving forward. But it's not just new players in the space. With the passing of the new legislation, had a number of regional center clients who have been very successful in the space get right back into it and start developing deal documents and trying to look into rural projects, what might be an infrastructure project. It's fantastic because there are different ways now that they can assist investors get through the immigration process in a more efficient way, and at the same time develop great projects. So I think it's been a nice bonus, or you know, in seeing how projects and developers have jumped right back into the space full force.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen that as well, and it's encouraging to see, especially some of the legacy guys that have been doing this for a while, and them being encouraged by what's out there. I will say that, you know, the conversations that I have with some of the people, because obviously they're hiring us to go raise the capital. We do that either on our own or through a variety of finders and potentially other broker dealers that we partner with. But the issues that we have, or the issues they have, are you know, things sort of like when we first started having conversations with people was, well, how long will it take? Can you guarantee I'm going to get the money? You know, obviously we know how to answer those questions. Now with the uncertainty of, okay, when will we be able to go out to market for things? Based on the last issue we talked about, as far as reauthorizing potentially regional centers needing to be reapproved, it's a harder question to answer as far as timing goes. I also think we have the sort of added, well, we know that there's pent-up demand. Nobody really knows what the ongoing market will be once that pent-up demand is processed of, you know, will there be interest? I know from, you know, when the rules changed the last time, even though it was temporary at the time, we didn't know it was temporary back in 2019. Then obviously COVID hit, so we really didn't get a good chance to see what that increased investment amount was, in fact, it was going to have on the market. It was obviously slightly higher, at least on the TEA investment side, 900,000 before, and you know, things weren't very robust. I'll say that. So it'll be interesting to see how. And I think there are other factors in play, but it'll be interesting to see what the market does sort of settle back into once we get past this initial flood of demand. And you know, but again, I think there are some things like we talked about before, concurrent filing, et cetera, that might drive some traffic that didn't, you know, wasn't there for to be able to drive before.
Right. Well, we'll see. And I don't know that the modernization rule era investors got a fair shake at how it would have turned out, how to, you know, kind of rolled into form, or, you know, in the end, because of all the other factors involved. There was so much up and down. And then, you know, with the defeat of the rules and the floodgates opening up, mm-hmm. It sure did make that time look bare, as you said. But there was at least some stability at some point during that process that I started to see help pick up on, gain momentum. You know, we were able to speak to the program at the time, what we thought was going to be a program just like that for many years, and investors, I think, liked that. So now with the longer term reauthorization, with the new legislation, perhaps we can, you know, people can take advantage of that and take comfort in that moving forward. Perhaps that will help generate momentum.
Absolutely. I hope so. And hopefully we'll get some answers sooner rather than later on that front. Well, with that, you know, that really kind of wraps up all the things that wanted to chat about today. Before we go, I'd like to ask you to, you know, let our audience know how people can reach you, whether they're investors or developers looking to maybe access EB5 capital. What's the best way to get in touch of with Christian Trondophilus?
Yes, sure. Well, happy to provide that. You know, I'm I'm always on my email at ctriantafyllis@jw.com, or even better, eb5-ct@jw.com. You can reach me also by on my office line, which is 713-752-4280. And I've got that office line wherever I am in the world. I'm somebody who travels often and will certainly be back out there on the road. I have to remain accessible. So those are probably the two best ways. And then we can take it from there, whether you enjoy, scheduled Zoom calls or the occasional WhatsApp connection. Happy to do that. But thanks again, Mike. I appreciate being part of this podcast, and hopefully your listeners found it to be helpful and valuable.
Great. Thank you, Christian. I appreciate you joining us today and for all of your valuable insight. I look forward to continue to work with you on cases going forward and your clients and our clients and helping them to have successful outcomes. And with that, we're going to be wrap up this episode two for Invest America, or Investing in America 101, hosted by Invest America. Please join us on our next episode. We're going to be talking about non-immigration private investment opportunities that are sponsored by our broker dealer, Sequence Financial Specialists. I'll be joined by my partner, Gene King, who will walk us through some of the current offerings that we have available. And these offerings are going to be interesting for people that are outside the United States that are looking to diversify their portfolio into sort of more traditional alternative investments, as well as anybody that is an EB-5 investor or previously from outside the United States living here now that are looking to potentially offset some taxable income. We have some tax advantaged private investment opportunities for those people as well. They're obviously living and working in the United States and they've got to pay taxes. So there might be some interesting investment opportunities for them to look to offset those taxes. So please join us next time for podcast episode number 3. We'll be talking about some non-immigration investment opportunities. So thank you again to Christian, and thank you for all of you for joining us today. We look forward to talking to you next time in the next episode of Investing in America 101. Thank you.